Thank you. I am so thrilled to be here, and what a great crowd. I'm not used to seeing so many students unless they were told that they had to show up and they were going to get extra credit. So this is inspirational. I spent the day on your campus, talked to two groups. What a phenomenal college. I'm very, very impressed. I want to thank NAMI, of course. I'm a lifetime member, and Colorado College and Aspen Point and Dog and Grow and Spill. Thank you. And thank you for being here tonight. I've come to you, I'm a journalist and I'm an author, but I've really come to you tonight to talk to you as a father, to share my story with you, to add my face to the many faces of mental illness. And my story begins with a frightening car ride and my son saying these words, "Dad, how would you feel if someone you loved killed himself?" My college-age son, Mike, and I were riding from New York City to Fairfax County, Virginia, outside of Washington, where we lived, when he asked me that question. Mike had been diagnosed a year earlier with a mental illness, bipolar disorder, and a doctor had put him on medication, but my son had stopped taking his pills. And when I picked him up that morning in New York, he'd been wandering around the city aimlessly for 5 days. He was convinced that God had him on a special mission. And during that four-hour car ride, he would laugh 1 minute and begin crying the next. And I said to him, "Please, please, take your medication." And he screamed at me, "Pills are poison. Leave me alone." And we got to the Fairfax Innova Hospital, and the intake nurse rolled her eyes while Mike talked gibberish about how God had him on this special mission. And then we were taken to a room all by ourselves where we proceeded to wait for the next 4 hours. And finally, my son said, "I've had enough. I'm going to leave. There's nothing wrong with me." And I said, "Hold on, hold on." And I went out and I literally grabbed a doctor and I pulled him in that room. And I will never forget how he came in. He came in with his hands up as if he was surrendering. And he said, "Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Early, but I really can't do anything to help your son." I said, "You haven't even examined him." And he explained to me that it didn't matter. That Virginia law was very specific. Unless a person posed an immediate, imminent danger to themselves or someone else, they could not be required to undergo treatment or take medication. And the fact that my son and I had been sitting in a room for 4 hours and no one got hurt was proof there was no danger. And the nurse had told the doctor that my son didn't want to take any pills. So the doctor looked at me and he says, "You seem like a nice guy. I'll tell you what, you bring your son back after he tries to kill you or he tries to kill someone else." Well, I took my son home, and during the next 48 hours, I saw him get sicker and sicker. At one point, he had tinfoil wrapped around his head to keep the CIA from reading his thoughts. He slipped out of my house one morning. He slipped out early in the morning. He slipped out. He broke into a stranger's house. Luckily, no one was there. He broke in to take a bubble bath. It took 5 police officers and an attack dog to get him out. And when they did, they took him over to our community mental health center, and they called me. And I raced over, and a policeman was standing outside, and he says, "Hold it, hold it, hold it. Let me give you a little advice as one father to another." He says, "Even though your son's told us that he has bipolar disorder, even though he's told us he's off his medication, even though we picked him up in a house that he'd broken into to take a bubble bath, unless you go in and you tell that doctor that your son's threatened to kill you, he will not meet Virginia's imminent danger criteria and he'll go to jail, and you don't want that." And I looked at him and I said, "But my son hasn't threatened to kill me." And he said, "That's up to you." And he walked off. So I'm here to tell you, and I do it without any pride at all, because it hurt my relationship with my son. I lied. I went in and I said my son had threatened to kill me, and that was good enough to get him taken into a hospital where 24 hours later he voluntarily committed himself. But our problems were far from over. 24 hours after my son was admitted, I got a call from his doctor, and he says, "Your insurance company wants him out. They say he doesn't need to be here. They're not going to pay for it." And I called that insurance company, and I got absolutely nowhere until I happened to mention that I used to work at the Washington Post. And I happened to mention that I was friends with Mike Wallace, and they should expect a call from 60 Minutes. Journalists are not supposed to bully people, but I did. And my son all of a sudden was allowed to stay in that hospital for a record-breaking 14 days. Finally, I thought, things can't get worse. And I discovered that they did. I got 2 calls. My son was being charged with 2 felonies, breaking and entering and destruction of property. I was so frustrated. And then a short time between our drive from New York to Virginia, I had violated my ethics by threatening people. I had lied to get him in. And now he was being charged with a crime that I tried to get him help. I couldn't. I didn't know what to do. I said to my wife, I want to help our son, but I don't know what to do. And she looked at me and she says, well, then why don't you do what you do best? Pete Early, a father, can't do much, but Pete Early, a journalist, can investigate this and try to find out what's going on. Well, for once, I actually listened to my wife. And I did a little digging, and I found out what happened to my son is not some aberration. It's not some freak occurrence. Right now, as you're sitting here on the beautiful Colorado campus, there are 600,000 people with bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and major depression in jails and prisons. There are more than 500,000 on probation. There are more than 1 million who go through the criminal justice system every year. And the largest public mental facility in the United States today is not a treatment center. It's the Los Angeles County Jail. And if you think Colorado is immune from that, consider this. A recent study found that there is a four-in-one chance if you live in colorful Colorado and you have a mental illness, 4-in-1 chance that you'll end up in jail rather than getting any kind of help. I told my son, I want to do something about this. And he said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to write a book about you. And he said, well, who would want to read that? And I said, no, I'm going to find a jail somewhere far away. I'm going to go in that jail and I'm going to find people who have mental illnesses. And I'm going to follow them through the system out in the streets to see what happens to them. Then I'll come back and I'll talk to the correctional officers and the judges and the parents and the consumers and the mental health experts and correction. And I'll try to make sense of it. And he said, Dad, if it helps someone else, tell my story. Well, I started the Los Angeles County Jail. Makes sense. Largest public mental facility. I lasted 2 days before they threw me out, citing HIPAA violations. I tried Cook County Jail, Chicago next, and they said, no, we're not going to let you in. I tried Rikers Island, and they said, no, we're not going to let you in. I tried Baltimore. They said, no, we don't want to let you in. I tried Washington, D.C., my hometown, and they said, hell no, we're not going to let you in. And I ended up going to the Miami-Dade jail because of a judge who let me in. And I'll never forget, as a journalist, stepping on the 9th floor, the C wing, the most psychotic wing, suicide inmates are kept. And you try to take in every kind of sight and sound when you're a journalist. C wing, it's a U-shaped cell block. 19 cells line the cell block. The officers walk up and down the center. Those cells all have plexiglass fronts. And when I looked into those cells, I saw men completely naked in cells that had nothing else in them. And because of a design flaw, the cells were kept cold, bone-chilling cold, but there were no blankets. And because it was an old system and medication made you thirsty and the old system broke down, oftentimes there was no water, so you saw people drinking from the toilets. And when you listened close, you could hear the normal jail sounds of doors slamming and people talking. But when you listen closer, you could hear the asylum sounds, people screaming at unseen tormentors. And then I heard a thud, 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 then louder, thud, 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 then faster, thud, thud, thud. It was one of the inmates running forward, smashing his forehead in the plexiglass, splitting it open. I ain't crazy, he screamed. Well, then stop acting like you are, the unconcerned officer called back. Now, during the 10 months I spent there, I got to know the officers, and they told me they called this the forgotten floor. And I thought, oh, they're talking about the inmates. But no, they were also talking about themselves. Not one of these officers had ever received any kind of education or skills on working with people with mental illness. And when I got to know them better, every officer told me that he'd been assigned to work with the crazies because it was the worst job in the jail. He was a troublesome employee. His bosses wanted him to quit. And they thought, oh, the best place to get rid of him and make him quit is to send him to the 9th floor. My tour guide on that floor was a wonderful doctor, Dr. Joseph Poitier, a psychiatrist with an impossible job. A lot of people think if you get your child arrested, you get them in jail, they'll get help. We don't help people here. We're a jail. We're not a hospital. There were 92 inmates on the 9th floor one day when I went with Dr. Poitier on his rounds. His rounds took us 19 and a half minutes. If you do the math, you'll see we spent 12 seconds talking to each one of those inmates. Now, I'm going to tell you about several of them. The first one is Alice Ann Collier, classic case of schizophrenia, homeless, living on the South Beach, wandering the streets. She's walking down the street, and her eyes lock with the eyes of an elderly woman waiting for a bus. And Alice Ann Collier screams, "Stop stealing my thoughts!" And she runs over, and she shoves the older woman, not hard enough to knock her over, but she shoves her, and she runs away. And well-meaning witnesses say, "Go get her arrested. Get her off the streets. She needs help. She'll get help." Well, she got arrested, but help is not what happened to Alice Ann Collier. Florida takes crimes against the elderly very seriously because so many people retire there. In fact, any crime against someone who's elderly is an automatic felony. And because Al Sancoyer had shoved two other people at bus stops, she was charged under that state's three strikes rule as a habitual criminal. And she faced a mandatory 5 years in prison, non-negotiable. But she was taken before the judge, and the judge looked down and he goes, "Wait a minute, I can't put this person on trial. She's not competent. She doesn't know what's going on." And you have to be competent in court. You have to know what's going on or you can't be put on trial. So he said, "I'm going to send you to the state hospital in Chattahoochee. You go to Chattahoochee and you get made competent." Get made competent. There's a difference between competence and treatment. Treatment means you get help, and that's not what happened to Alison Collier. Every day she was taken into a room, and she was shown three chairs. On one chair was written the word judge, the other one defense attorney, and the third one prosecutor. And when Alison Collier could tell her keepers who sat in each chair, she was deemed competent enough to be put on trial, and she was sent back to the judge. And the judge looked down, and he went, "Wait a minute. I sent you away to be made competent. Why are you here? Go back to Chattahoochee." When I found Alice Ann Collier in the Miami-Dade jail, she had been traveling between the jail and the state hospital 1,151 days, more than 3 years, and she'd never been put on trial. Now, I'm a reporter. I took out my little pen and paper. I wrote it down. I go running over to the prosecutors. "Look what I found. Look what I found." And they told me with absolutely no embarrassment that they knew absolutely what they were doing with Alice Ann Collier. In fact, they planned to keep her on that bus going back and forth for 5 years, which was the legal maximum they could keep her without putting her on trial. Why? Because she was psychotic. Medications didn't seem to help her be stable. And there was no safe place. There was no safe place in the entire state of Florida. No hospital beds, no long-term treatment facilities, no place. So they were keeping her on that bus, just shuffling her back and forth to keep her off the streets. Now, she was typical. The kind of person I was meeting in the jail was not a Hannibal Lecter serial killer psychopath. It was somebody who had bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or major depression. I was very fortunate after my book was published. I got to testify before Congress, but before I did, a panel of experts, the best, the brightest, the best minds in America testified before me, these doctors, esteemed doctors, and they all said exactly the same thing, that bipolar disorder and schizophrenia and major depression are illnesses. The heart can get sick, and so can the mind. Unfortunately, we don't know what causes them. No one can tell you what causes bipolar disorder. The latest thinking is they're genetically linked. Environmental stress brings them out. But the truth is, we don't know. And the other truth is, we don't have any medicines that can cure mental illness. Instead, we're spending millions and millions on medications that simply alleviate some of the symptoms. Now, the good news is that these medications often can help large amounts of people. And with other services, you can help. Recovery is possible. Most people can recover from a serious mental illness. Most people can recover from a serious mental illness. But first, you have to have facilities available to them, and you have to have a way to get them into that treatment program. Consider April Hernandez, same age as my son. When I found her in the jail, she was serving time for stealing a car. And I investigated, and guess what, folks? She had been framed. Who framed April Hernandez? Her own parents. Why would parents frame their kid wanting him arrested? Because April Hernandez was psychotic. She was homeless. She was living on the streets of South Beach, where she'd been gang raped twice and attacked three times by teenagers swinging baseball bats who thought it was hilarious to beat up homeless people. And there was nothing anyone could do because she was not considered to be dangerous to herself or others. Now, her mental situation had been masked for years because as a teenager, she'd started using drugs. And everybody went, "Oh, that's why she acts so erratically." It was only after she's correctly diagnosed as having both a mental illness and a drug and alcohol problem that they understood that she was medicating herself and that she needed help with co-occurring disorders. And 40% of people with serious mental illness have co-occurring disorders, and 90% of people with severe mental illnesses have co-occurring disorders, and 100% of the people I met in the jail in Miami had co-occurring problems. The final person I want to mention to you is Freddie Gilbert. I don't care if you live in beautiful Colorado Springs or you live in Washington, D.C., you know Freddie Gilbert. A Miami study found that in a population of 2 million at any given time, there were 1,700 people who were living in cars and public shelters and sleeping on the streets. They were homeless. But that same study found that those 1,700 people, most were able to move through the social system into some kind of supportive housing, except 507 individuals. 507 chronic homeless, always homeless, always on the street. And in Miami, those 507 all have a severe mental illness. And in Miami, those 507 all have been arrested more than once. And when I checked Gilbert's record, I found out he had been in and out of that jail a dozen times in the last year alone, but he'd never gotten any help because that was because he was charged with misdemeanors. So he was stuck in this cycle, 2 or 3 weeks on the street, 2 or 3 weeks back in the jail. And when I met him, he was so sick he could not speak. He stood naked in his cell and he grunted like an animal, and they gave him sandwiches as if he were a dog performing the treats to keep him in line. He was one of a persons that are called frequent flyers. How in the world did we get into this situation? Well, if you're a student of history, you'll learn that we've come full circle back in the 1700s. If you had a mental illness, you were in jail, your family took care of you, or the sheriff warned you out. He took you to the county line and said, you start walking and never come back here. In 1843, Dorothea Dix was going to teach a Bible lesson in Boston, and she's going through the jail, and she goes through a part of the jail and there's no heat and it's freezing, and she goes, you can't treat people like this. And she goes to the jailer and she says, those people are freezing, they need heat. And the jailer said to her, oh, those are the lunatics. They don't feel the cold. They're not like us. They don't need heat. Well, Dix went on a campaign of trying to teach people that persons with mental illness needed treatment, not punishment. And she personally persuaded 33 states to open up hospitals for treating people, not punishing them. Well, we all know what happened next. During the next 50 years, many of these state hospitals turned into giant warehouses where people were locked up and forgotten and never released. One newspaper reporter in Oklahoma in the 1960s said the state hospitals there were worse, and I just said worse, than Nazi concentration camps. In 1963, President Kennedy heard the cry for reform, and he called on Congress to pass a mental health community basis bill. He wanted to move people out of these institutions back into the community. The discovery of a promising new drug called Thorazine seemed to make it possible for people to live off these locked wards. And Kennedy's plan called for the spending of $3 billion, the opening of 2,000 community-based mental health centers. Well, what happened? Kennedy was assassinated. Congress got ensnarled in Watergate. The Vietnam War escalated. Thorazine turned out not to be nearly as wonderful as everybody thought. Neighborhoods proved not to be as welcoming as they should have been. In short, that $3 billion never got set aside as promised. Those 2,000 centers never opened as promised. Next came deinstitutionalization, the forced closing of these giant hospitals. It was a fabulous idea that quickly turned into a cruel joke. Why? Because states began closing them down overnight without having any kind of safety net in the communities. And overnight, people were literally shoved out the door onto the streets where they went in substandard boarding homes, nursing homes, or in our jails and prisons. Now, look, I'd seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I, like you, probably thought, wow, the closing of these hospitals, they did that out of compassion, out of concern, because these places were horrible and we needed to close them down. But it wasn't compassion and it was not concern that led to the closing of the state hospitals. If you check your history books, you'll discover it was all about the money. State legislators were being pushed into a corner. They were being told, you can't treat people like this. You have to start spending money and fix those places up. Reporters were doing exposés. The public was saying, this is awful. This is bedlam. You can't treat people like this. And the state legislators were going, oh my gosh, what are we going to have to do? We're going to have to raise taxes. And Uncle Sam came riding in on a horse and said, no, we'll save you. We'll take care of people with mental illnesses, but only if you get them out of those institutions. Get them out of there. And state legislators went, whoopee, great. Let's let Uncle Sam take care of it and push people out the door. Well, what did the federal government do? It didn't do any better job than the states had. And in fact, in 1980, we created a perfect storm. How did we do that? We elected Ronald Reagan, and we sent him to Washington, and we said, get Uncle Sam off our backs. Get his hands out of our pockets. We're tired of big government taking our money. And you know what? Reagan did it. He began cutting the very programs that we said we were going to use to help people with mental illness. Look at housing alone. In the Reagan administration, it was cut from $32 billion to $7 billion. Well, it's been 4 decades since deinstitutionalization, 3 decades since the Reagan Revolution. Why are jails and prisons still filling up with people whose major crime is they got sick? Well, the truth is, despite everything that's happened, we still don't have adequate community mental health services across this country. Let's go back to Miami where I did my investigation. Not everybody in Miami is sitting in a jail. There are 4,500 people in Miami with major mental illnesses. These are people who would have been in a state hospital. We got them out of there. We got them in our local community. That is fantastic. That's wonderful. But look where they live. They live in 650 boarding homes. 650 boarding homes are called assisted living facilities in Florida. Of those 650 boarding homes, 400 of them cannot pass the minimum standards to operate as a boarding home. In other words, if you tried to put anybody but someone with a mental health problem in that boarding home, it would be against the law. One of the ones I visited had a hole in the roof. Rain was pouring through. Medications were scattered on a kitchen table. The caretaker only spoke Spanish. None of the tenants spoke Spanish. Meals were rice and beans. There was no therapy. There was no treatment. There was nothing but smoking cigarettes and watching TV. And I would argue in this case, we have not improved these people's lives by moving them out of the hospitals. We're just hiding them better. Well, it's easy for me to stand up here and say, ooh, look at those slumlords. They're horrible. Let's dig a little deeper. The average operator of a boarding home in Florida and Miami receives $29.90 per day to take care of every patient and cover all their needs, medications, food, clothing, everything. $29.90 today. When I travel, I put my dog in the, and you can tell I'm from Washington area, Dulles Executive Pet Center. And they charge me $34 a day to take care of my dog, give my dog a walk, give it its medication, and house it. In other words, I pay $5 more a day to take care of my dog than what we're paying people in Miami to take care of persons with severe mental disorders. Well, it's easy to pick on Florida, so let's pick on my hometown, Fairfax County, Virginia. Now, I grew up in Colorado. I know what a beautiful state you have here, and I know you folks think you got it made and you don't want anybody else to know it, but I'm sorry, heaven is not Colorado. Heaven is Fairfax County, Virginia, and I'm going to prove it to you, all right? The average household income in the United States, the amount that the people in the house earn, is $45,000 a year. Fairfax County, Virginia, the average household income is $150,000 a year, 3 times more. And that's because both people work for the federal government, and that's your tax dollars, so thank you very much. All right? Yet, according to the Washington Post, if you have a mental illness in Fairfax County, Virginia, with all that money, there's a 2-week wait to get into a treatment program. There is a 6-week wait to get a case manager, and there is an 18-year wait to get into any kind of housing. That's shameful. Is it any wonder I call my book crazy? I'm not talking about persons with mental illness. I'm talking about our system. Well, there's other reasons why our jails and prisons are our new asylums. In the 1980s, we said, wait a minute. We need to improve civil rights for persons who have mental illnesses. It should not be against the law to have a mental illness. You shouldn't get locked up because you're hearing voices. And that is absolutely correct. And then we said, wait a minute. It is not right to grab somebody and throw them in one of these institutions and stick an ice pick up under their eyelid and scramble the front part of their brain and say, guess what? You've now been cured. Congratulations. You should have a right to specify what kind of treatment you want. And the civil rights attorneys did this, and they weren't trying to hide it. They decided that the best thing that could happen was to keep people out of these state hospitals by making the criteria as tough as possible. And the criteria became imminent danger. And a judge ruled that a man who had chronic schizophrenia, who was eating his own feces and sleeping under cars, was not doing anything dangerous because neither of those acts are life-threatening. I know how we have treated people with mental illnesses. And I love my son. And I worry about his civil rights. But I'm telling you, only focusing on dangerousness
is short-sighted. No one knows who might become dangerous. In the last several years, many states have grappled with this, and they said, okay, we're going to do gravely disabled. We're going to do unable to care for self or others. But the truth is, it always comes down to dangerousness, because we don't know how to protect people's civil rights and yet also help them when they're clearly psychotic. We have to find a better way. We have to find a way to protect people, but not wait until they become dangerous. No father should be told, bring your son back after he tries to kill you or someone else. And there's a third reason why our jails and prisons are our new asylums. And we thought HMOs were the gift of everything. It's going to make everything fantastic. It's going to make affordable health care. But by 1997, 2/3 of HMOs were owned by for-profit companies, and every psychiatric bed in this country loses money. We're closing them down. We're closing them down, replacing them with surgical beds, which make money. In Virginia, my home state, now 24% of all private hospital beds have been closed down. And during the next year, 1,200 people who meet the dangerous criteria will not get any help because there are no beds available. How are we responding to this crisis? Well, what we've managed to do is, since the mental health has failed us, we're now turning to the criminal justice to save us. We have turned mental health from a mental health problem into a criminal justice problem. And some of the good news is that here in Colorado Springs, you have crisis intervention training for police officers. You don't want Rambo coming through the door when you have somebody who's paranoid, schizophrenic. We're setting up mental health courts. Why should you take somebody like my son and put him through the normal system? Why not put him in a court that can direct him into treatment and spare the criminal justice system? We're doing reentry programs where we say, this is stupid. We got somebody in jail who's clearly psychotic, and we're turning them loose and rearresting them. Let's line them up with services before they leave. And these programs are sweeping the country. CIT, mental health, jail diversion. They're fabulous. They're wonderful. I endorse them. They are absolutely important in every community. But I'm here to tell you, we should have learned a lesson we forgot. Diverting a person, we've forgotten because of deinstitutionalization, diverting a person from a jail is fabulous if you have somewhere to divert them to. If you don't have any meaningful mental health services in your community, no access to affordable medication, no critical care crisis beds where people can be treated, no long-term crisis beds where people extremely ill can receive treatment and become stable, no assertive community treatment teams, no evidence-based best practices that include peer-to-peer, no supportive housing, no clubhouses, no hope for recovery, then the best CIT, the best mental health, the best jail diversion are going to fail. If you want to keep people in Colorado who are sick out of your jails and prisons, then you need to improve and broaden your community mental health services so they never end up in your jails and prisons. Let's use some common sense. Look, if I had a broken leg, I wouldn't call up your police department and say, come over and fix my leg. And if I needed a heart surgery, I wouldn't call up your sheriff and say, hey, can you come over, send a few boys over and do a little open heart surgery. And if I had hemorrhoids, I wouldn't call up your local judge and say, hey, judge, can you come over and take a look? Then why are we expecting the police and the sheriff and the judges to fix a mental health problem? We need to wake up and understand that you can't talk in Colorado about mental health reform unless you want to talk about housing. And you can't talk in Colorado about mental health reform unless you want to talk about jobs. And you can't talk about it unless you want to talk about transportation. You can't talk about it unless you want to talk about veterans and TBIs. You can't talk about it unless you want to talk about access to affordable medication. Mental health is a community challenge. It shouldn't be a criminal justice problem. You know, people say to me, oh, schizophrenia, it's the worst disease. We really can't help those people. And I always respond with one word, bull. And I cut that short out of respect for you. People get better. People recover. I have seen amazing things. I have visited almost every state but two in this country. I've been to 3 foreign countries. I have toured over 100 programs. And I'm here to tell you, this is not a problem of not knowing what to do. We know what to do. We just don't want to do it. In Miami, I found a program that sounded impossible. It was taking people with schizophrenia, the worst mental illness, people who had killed other people, committed serious crimes, taking them out of prison and moving them back into the community. How is that possible? Well, because these people had committed felonies, they weren't given a choice. They had to take medication. And they only took people who did well on medication. But look what they did. The program was called Passageway. And you know what? They didn't put these people in the cheapest medication. They found medications that actually helped them with the fewest side effects possible. And they worked with them to include compliance and understanding why this medication was important. And then the doctors at Passageway, the psychiatrists, they did something that is really revolutionary. They actually talked to their patients. Do you know of my son's 8 psychiatrists, only 2 have known anything about him except his name and his symptoms? And that is because we have told psychiatrists, the insurance companies have told them, you have 15 minutes, your job is to diagnose, figure out what pill goes in their mouth, and let cheaper paid social workers deal with their other problems. But helping someone with their mind also requires helping them with their heart. And clients were giving housing. How can you get better if you're sleeping under a bridge, getting beaten up and gang raped? You have to have a safe place to live. And they became part of a community. Tom Mullen, the program's founder, told me the secret. And he said, at Passageway, we're not a giant warehouse. We're a community where people actually care about people, where they're not stigmatized. We're a parish where they're not isolated, where they're not shunned, but they're accepted. So you got medications, and you have jobs, and you have housing, and you have community acceptance. Those are the spokes on a wheel. What holds that wheel together? What is the wheel center that is necessary for recovery? And I'm here to tell you it's something rather simple. It's called hope. In the most successful programs I've seen, the people who are sick and the people who are helping them must have, above everything else, hope. Now, I'm not naive here. I know these are cruel diseases. I know that all people are not going to survive. But without hope, you cannot get better, because no one ever will unless they have the belief that they can. Hal Lindsey, the actor, said it best, man can live about 40 days without food, about 3 days without water, about 8 minutes without air, but only 1 second without hope. Which brings me to you. What can you do? What can you do here in beautiful Colorado Springs? First, if you only get one thing out of the speech, remember this. You can make a difference. I have seen it. Fort Wayne, Indiana, a father whose son committed suicide by cop. That father went to New York. He learned about Fountain House, which is a jobs program where they say, okay, Pete, you can't work an 8-hour day. You work 2 hours. And you'll get paid for that. But we're going to give you a job because jobs make you feel better. He took that back to Fort Wayne, Indiana. He changed that entire community. One person did that. Margaret Mead said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed people can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. What can you do? Educate the public. There should be no shame in having a mental illness. There should only be shame in not helping someone who does. Right now, the face... face of mental illness is the Tucson shooter. It's the Virginia Tech shooter. It should be Mike Wallace. It should be Jane Pauley. It should be Catherine Zeta-Jones, who has a nice face. What can you do? Educate your politicians. People like Freddie Gilbert aren't going away. They're going to cost your community money. Do you want to keep blowing the money, having them return to jail, or do you want to actually help them? Right now in Miami, there are 1,200 people with serious mental illness sitting in jail. They cost $100,000 a day. They don't get any better. For half that, you could give them housing and give them an assertive community treatment team that would help them recover. We need to shift funds away from jails and prisons into community treatment that actually works instead of wasting it on temporary band-aids. What can you do? The last thing, never give up. You know, like all parents, my son got sick and I thought, okay, we got over this. He got probation. He was on probation for 2 years. Mike did fantastic, got a job, was employee of the month. As soon as his probation ended, he stopped taking his pills. My son started to slip. Now, in Fairfax County, we have a mobile crisis response team. I called him up. I said, my son is slipping. Please come over. Please, he needs your help. And they said, well, is he dangerous? And I said, no, he's not dangerous, but listen to what happened last time. They said, wait a minute, that's unfair. You can't judge him on what happened last time. You call him if he becomes dangerous. Well, the night that my son became violent, the night I didn't have to lie, I called that same dispatcher and I said, my son is violent, please come. And the dispatcher said, now, wait a minute. is he dangerous or is he violent? And I said, he's violent. He says, oh, we don't come if someone's violent. You need to call the police. Well, I called the police and two officers came and they shot my son with a taser and they hogtied him and they took him away. Now, I'm telling you that story for a reason. If I couldn't help my son after 3 years of investigating the mental health system, writing a book about it with my fancy-dancy connections with Mike Wallace, living in one of the most expensive counties in the United States, what chance do you think somebody who has no political connections, no education, may not even speak the language, what chance do they have here in Colorado Springs in getting help? Well, my son was hospitalized. He got better. He was doing fine. He had another breakdown about a couple years go by. He goes off his medicines again. It's Thanksgiving. He's terrified. I'm going to call the police. I realize that he's slipping. I try to talk to him. He jumps in the car and he takes off. And I call him and I say, where are you going? Where are you going? He says, I'm going to paradise. I said, well, come back home, please. I'm worried about you. No, I'm not coming home. Well, he got to North Carolina. He ran out of gas and he called me and he said, Dad, if I step out of the car, I'm going to die. Now you're looking there going, oh yeah, right. What makes you know that you're here tonight? What makes you know that I'm in front of this podium? Your mind does. And I'm telling you, if your mind's telling you you're going to die, if you step out of your car, you believe that. I said, what can I do? He says, don't come. Don't call the police. Just get me some gasoline and I'll drive home. So I allowed my son to drive home for 4 hours on I-95, completely psychotic. Twice he went off the road. Luckily, no one was hurt. We talked until our battery went out and the cell phones. He showed up at my house. He says, I don't want to take medication. I said, you need to find a safe place. So we agreed he'd go into a house in Fairfax County where people can go with mental illnesses just to get away and collect their thoughts. In the middle of the night, he got up. He took off all his clothes because he thought that made him invisible. And he went walking down the street. But let me tell you what happened this time. I couldn't have written this better. A CIT-trained police officer saw him and he stopped and picked him up. And he took him to the very same hospital that had refused my son help. And he went in and the doctor came in and he said, look, there's nothing dangerous about a person walking down the street naked. I'm not going to commit this person to a hospital. We don't have enough beds. And the CIT officer said, really? You know, I looked up your address. You live over in Reston. I'm going to go drop him off in your front yard. He did. My son was taken to the hospital. He got a case manager. That case manager got him into an apartment with two people with schizophrenia. That case manager helped me become dad instead of, are you on your meds? Are you off your meds? Why are you laughing? Why are you not laughing? That case manager got him involved in peer-to-peer. Today, my son is a peer-to-peer specialist. He is paid to go into the county jail, talk to people with mental illness, try to find out what's wrong with them, and try to get them help. So don't tell me that we can't help people. I have seen it. My son has been stable for 4 years, and he's doing great. So hope is possible. I'm going to close now. I'm going to tell you a story, but because I am from Washington, I'm going to give you a warning, okay? I'm about to tell a religious story. I'm not doing it because I'm pro-religion or anti-religion. I just like the story, okay? And I like it because of the imagery. Now, I grew up in a little town called Fowler. My dad was a minister. And that meant every Wednesday night and every Sunday, I got dragged to church. And I got real good sitting there like this and not listening to a word my dad said. But there was always one story that snapped me to attention. And that's because it was about a woman who's having sex. Okay? They're in the Bible. You just got to know where to look. All right? This woman is caught in adultery. Notice in the Bible, it's always the women who are committing adultery. She's dragged into the center of the town. People are gathering around. They're going to stone her. They're going to kill her because of this horrible, horrible thing that she has done. And the teacher says, let ye who's never sinned throw that first stone. And we read that people put down the rocks and they walked away because all of us are guilty. None of us are pure. Everyone has done something. Sadly, we live in a society today where people don't put down those rocks. They are eager to throw them. That are people who are different, who have co-occurring problems, who have mental illnesses. They want to lock them up. They want to drive them away. They want them off the streets. They want to get rid of them. As people who care about persons with mental illness, as people who have mental illnesses, as people who cared enough to show up tonight, I believe you are what I call stone catchers, people who stand between the angry mob and people who can't defend themselves, and you defend them until they can join you. And it's the stone catchers in our society who give me hope. My son has a mental illness. To me, this cruel disease wears his face, and I will be forever grateful to people like you who can look beyond the madness in his eyes and see people, a person who's loved and cared for and has a mother and father and brothers and sisters who love him. So thank you for coming tonight. Thank you for being a stone catcher. Thank you for caring about others. I can guarantee you, you get involved in NAMI, you get involved in changing our system, you get involved in helping people with mental illness, whether it's through Dog or Spill or Grow, and you will affect somebody's life. You will change a life. Thank you very much. You're very, very kind and very patient. Did you want to answer a few questions now or not? Are you ready for a buzz? Of course I have energy. We'll keep them short, though. I'll give you a warning. I am from Washington. I can talk a lot and not answer anything. And then we're going to close by having Buzz come up and say something. But if you have a few questions, I will be glad to avoid them. Yes, sir. Right. Okay, I'm going to tell you, I'm so glad you asked that question. I am energized on this because, listen, you can go to your politician and you can say, my son has a mental illness. And he's going to say, okay, that's horrible. He doesn't have one in his family. And you know what? His sister has breast cancer. So he's a little more interested in that. And you know what? The voters are all saying, I'm tired of having 38 kids in a classroom. Where do you think mental illness is going to end up? It's going to end up on the bottom of the heap. Why? Because we don't have a pack and because we have stigma and we're afraid to get out there. Now I'm going to tell you how to beat that. Other groups come. They can't do what we can do. We can save you money, Mr. County Commissioner, and I'm going to show you how. Do you know how much your jails are wasting? Do you know how much mental illness is costing your community and you don't even know about it? The Washington Post did a study. Who makes the number one 911 calls? Because we're in Washington, we're so brilliant, we spend $500 every time somebody makes a 911 call. Okay? The number one person made 251 calls. He had schizophrenia. He just wanted somebody to talk to her. He wanted a ride. That's the untreated cost. But facts and figures. San Antonio, Texas, CIT drop-in center saved $3 million in that county's budget by avoiding jail, avoiding having people locked up and going through the criminal justice system. There's the facts. There's the figures. You can go to Orlando, ask their behavioral mental health there. How many days did they save keeping people out of jail, keeping people off the streets? And you can show this is makes sense. You can save money. You invest it now, you'll save down the line. You build a prison, 16% of those people are going to have mental illness. They're going to cost you a ton. And, you know, the number one people in this country fighting for mental health reform are not mental health advocates. I'm sorry, it's not NAMI. It's the sheriffs and it's the police chiefs. Why? Because their budgets are getting eaten up by drug costs, because they were not trained to take care of these people. They want them out, but we're at a tipping point because they're getting tired of getting beaten up. If you got a reporter here, have them do something about your jail. Unless you live in a great place that the guy has really been bright about this, you're going to have 16%. You're going to have awful conditions. Well, sheriffs are going to get tired of getting beaten up, so they're going to start building better facilities. And you know what we're going to do? We're going to build the state hospitals inside the jails and prisons. And that's what we don't want. But the big thing, sorry I'm so long-winded, but I get excited about this, is we have facts and figures that will show your county commissioner how you will save money if you implement these programs in the criminal justice system rather than wasting it, spending it. But that's not the whole answer. It really isn't all about money. California passed the millionaire's tax. They raised $1 billion just for mental health. And you know what? They squandered it. So it takes using your head, using the community, and thinking about the best way to help people. So, yes, sir. I didn't know that, and you're obviously much better addressing this than I am, but parity was supposed to take care of that. That was NAMI's big deal. We pushed through parity. When parity is, you have to treat people with mental illness just like everybody else. I don't know how they're getting away with that. Maybe NAMI knows or something, but that's the key. If you study mental illness, I'm sorry to say this, I know it sounds really awful, but it's all about the money. It's all about the money. Yes, sir. So they limited it to five specific illnesses? Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. I know that in some states where I've gone, the businesses have set up some corporations to save money have hired a psychiatric nurse's aide, and you have to go see her, and she decides whether you really need to go out into the community and get aid. And of course, who wants to go to their employer and say, you know, especially if you're in a field like a policeman or an airline pilot or something like that. So it's another one of those things. You know, we're going to run into that. And the only way we're not going to run into that, and I know I sound very naive here, but the only way we're not going to do that is when we finally start defeating stigma and standing up and making people realize that these aren't illnesses. They need to be treated like illnesses. And we got to get some clout. You know, the Virginia governor was a friend of mine. He said, Pete, you're not going to do anything because you don't have a PAC. You don't give me any money and you don't give me any votes. And so I'm not going to listen to you. And that's what we got to change. And there's a couple ways we can do that. One way is by doing what Buzz and Elaine are doing, which is standing up and saying, look, this happened in my family. This happened to me. Put a face on mental illness. We need to get reporters to go down to, I'm not picking on your jail. You might have a great jail here, and I hope you do. But what I'm saying is get people in these. Make them aware. When my book came out, Miami passed a $22 million bond issue to improve mental health services because they were horrified by what I saw. People will react, but we have to speak out. Yes, ma'am. Good. Then write to Jeannie Ritter. Her sister has bipolar disorder, and I've been out to Denver several times. She's the former first lady. Send a book. I'll give you a free book. Send it to the DA who's prosecuting that case. That's outrageous. Get NAMI to write letters. You know, it's interesting. They were doing things in Miami where parents were so desperate. Here's what typically happened is your son or daughter became violent. You were scared. You called the police. You knew they had to be violent in order to meet dangerousness or something else. You called the police. The police showed up. Then they arrested them, took them to jail. Then you went down and bonded them out. And then they said, well, because it's a family assault, they can't go home with you. So thanks a lot. you know, where am I? Well, all those parents did was they were told you can't talk to a judge, so they found out his fax number and would send him a letter saying, you know, my son has a mental illness. And yeah, yeah. This is a NAMI board member, and he doesn't mind, publicize the heck out of that case. Yeah, that's what I would do. I would publicize it, call up the local newspaper. My book was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, one of two finalists. It's not because I'm such a great writer. It's because this is such a huge problem. The one who won was about Al-Qaeda, and the other one was about the Iraq War. I'm telling you, people, this involves so many of us. One in four, we should be a huge group. Sorry, I can talk forever. We're done.
So, yeah, you're going to introduce Buzz, are you?
No, you can do it.
Okay.
Okay.
I will.
So, this is the hook.
Go
ahead. Thank you. Thank you so much, Pete. It was just really wonderful to hear from you. Means a lot. Buzz Blackett and... I don't know if Elaine's not coming up, but Buzz is coming up. Buzz is David Blackett's father, and David was a student here at CC, and Buzz is going to say a few words in closing. When Buzz is finished, I hope you all go out into the lobby. Pete will be out there signing books. We've got the NAMI table out there as well as the Aspen Point table, and cookies and coffee, so... Stay, come out in the lobby, socialize. Thanks.
If our son David knew that he had, his name was spread far and wide in connection with this program, in connection with yesterday's program that the kids had, his first reaction would have been anger. His mental illness was a personal, private thing. He didn't want anybody to know about it. He didn't believe it was anybody's business. And there was stigma all over it. But I think if David could see what a difference it's made, his memory and the way the great kids at CC have rallied around that memory to try to build awareness, build organizations to keep other tragedies from happening and get the help to people that need it, he'd be very happy. When we got the invitation to come back here tonight, we knew how great Colorado College was. We didn't know much about NAMI and the way the great interaction that NAMI has had with the college and the kids. I've become a believer in the last 24 hours in the organization, and I guess I would just suggest to people that we're doing exactly what we should be doing right now, and everybody needs to go out and put their face on mental illness, whether you're helping somebody, whether you've suffered in the past, so we can get rid of this stigma. Thanks.